This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 69 was recorded on June 29th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Hyundai Investments CIO Alex Gurevich will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll be discussing the reflation trade rollover, the equity outlook, why Alex is still bullish on bonds and bearish on the Swiss franc, and a whole lot more. But wait, there's more. After the feature interview, we're going to bring you a second guest to continue our expanded coverage of the crude oil market. Now, while the name Tracy Shuchart might not be immediately familiar to some of you, if you're on Twitter, you already know that one oil trader is particularly legendary in that community. So at ShyGirl and I will be discussing the current bounce in crude oil prices, how long it will last, and where the trend is headed from here with respect to oil prices.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Now, Eric, let's go and take a look at this S&P 500. What a crazy few days in the markets. Now, we started the week off with a 30-point plunge. The market completely rebounded. And then today, we had an outright market rout of 40-plus S&P points with a substantial spike in that volatility index. What's your thinking about the markets here?
Well, to be honest, the spike in the VIX is more interesting to me than the price action in the S&P. We're still at a level, like it or not, where we're above the 50-day moving average, although I think we, on an intraday basis, peaked below it just for a few minutes earlier in the day today on Thursday. But you can't say, based on price action, that, okay, you know, the end is nigh and the market's going to roll over here. On the other hand, we've heard so many people, whether it be Jesse Felder or others that we've had on the program, saying that this bull market is awfully long in the teeth. Now, what does tend to happen when these things start to fall apart is you get sudden spikes in volatility. And the downside tape action today that was coupled with a very big spike up in volatility, that definitely kind of got my attention as a warning message. But it's still a yellow flag at this point. It's not a red flag yet because we haven't seen the follow through in terms of both volume and price level. But these are the way these things start. So on the one hand, that could be a bearish sign. On the other hand, if you look at this from a seasonality standpoint, you'd really expect that it would be around the beginning of September, not the end of June, that you might start see volatility spikes coming into the market that would be the precursor for maybe a really big move to the downside. So it's a bit early seasonally, and we haven't seen enough yet, but certainly when you start to see volatility spikes, it's time to pay close attention. I'm happy to be on the sidelines. I have no exposure whatsoever to equities here. I've got plenty of other things to invest in where I have much stronger views and much higher conviction.
Well, you know, while the S&P 500 has had that volatility and we can see that spike in the VIX, another market that is moving is that U.S. dollar index. The euro and the pound and the Canadian dollar all jumping higher as the dollar index gives out the 97 level and down toward, well, I think about 95.29 at the time we're recording here. What's your thinking on the dollar index?
Well, this chart is scary to be sure. You know, we've seen this coming. Even people like myself who are very dollar bullish, Julian Brigden in the same camp, seeing a secular bullish view on the U.S. dollar, have said, boy, look at this chart. It's time to get out of the way of this thing. I think that the perception that everything is rosy in Europe, which I certainly don't agree with, but the rally in the euro is accounting for a lot of this weakness in the dollar. Question in my mind is, how low does it go? I do think this is a buy the dip opportunity. I don't see the secular bear argument for the U.S. dollar index, but it's clear that this thing's gotten serious, and who knows how much further it could go. Somehow, and this is not really based on any formal technical analysis, Patrick, but off the top of my head, you know, 92, 91 and a half was a really key support level 6 months to a year ago. I kind of have a gut feeling that we're headed towards a retest of that. Whether or not that's really going to be the buy the dip opportunity or not, I'm not sure. I'm going to be looking for perspective from some of our guests in coming weeks as to what that magic level is to buy the dollar at. But it feels to me like the downside action's not over yet.
Another market that was quite oversold was that crude oil. We're finally getting a bit of a bounce up toward that 45 level. It's at 44.85 on my screen. What's your thinking here on crude?
Well, as I said last week, we were way overdue for a bounce, even as bearish as I've been about crude oil. Clearly, we were overdue for the bounce. We're getting that bounce now. Now, on a technical level, if I look at this chart, you could very easily argue, Patrick, that we're headed back towards 49 or so on West Texas Intermediate crude oil. If you just look at the price channel that's been in play, that seems to be the next move. The thing is, and this is just my subjective interpretation of the facts here, we got a lot of tailwinds for crude oil this week. You've got weather that was shutting in the ports on the Gulf Coast, that was shutting in production and the rigs offshore in the Gulf Coast. There was a lot of reason to think that crude oil should have, I think, done a little better than it has this week. So even in the face of no more rhetoric from OPEC and a bad weather situation in the Gulf of Mexico with Tropical Storm Cindy, you know, it's still, this is the best we can do is 45. So I kind of wonder, once the weather clears, how long it's going to last, if we're really going to get back to 49 or not. As far as inventory this week, expectations were for a drawdown. We had a build. It was a de minimis build. 118,000 barrels is not very much for a national crude oil inventory build. But hey, it's a build, and it's happening at the height of summer driving season. That got a lot of people's attention. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 297,000 barrels. Gasoline was probably where a lot of the tape action came from, drawing down 894,000 barrels. Not monster huge, but finally, in the summer driving season, we're getting a summer driving season-like drawdown in gasoline inventories. Distillates drawing down less than that, only 223,000 barrels there. U.S. production was off notably this week. And that, as far as I can tell, seems to be what's propelling the bulls to get all excited about how the trend is changing and shale's not really coming online and all this other nonsense. I have three words for them. Tropical Storm Cindy. The reason that U.S. production is off this week is because of weather in the Gulf of Mexico. It's not going to last, folks. If you want to understand what's going to happen to U.S. production, just take the rig count chart, lag it by a few months, and you'll see that that growth is going to continue. We've got to get through. I wouldn't be surprised if next week, again, we see more Tropical Storm Cindy related slowdown of production. It's transient. It's not going to last. So my thinking, though, Patrick, is the really, really big story this week is what OPEC said about the oil market. Precisely nothing. And not so much this week, but last week when we were seeing this massive sell-off to levels not seen in 7 or 8 months. And OPEC has nothing to say? Saudi Arabia is not out making some kind of propaganda press release? What is going on there? Because these guys are good at their game. They are generally very much prepared every time there is a inventory report to immediately counter it with some kind of bullish propaganda. And we've seen nothing for the last few weeks. Now, all I can think of is there has been a changing of the guard in Saudi Arabia, where the previous heir apparent to the throne has been replaced by the king's son, Mohammed bin Salman. MBS, as he's known, is kind of an interesting guy. A lot of people aren't sure what to anticipate from him next. He's had a lot of views about getting Saudi Arabia out of the business of oil export and into the business of tourism. I'm not sure exactly where the appeal is going to be for tourism in Saudi Arabia, but you know, something's going on there. So absent a return of the propaganda campaigns from Saudi Arabia and OPEC, and once the weather clears in the Gulf of Mexico, I'm skeptical that this rally can continue. So do we get all the way to 49 before it reverses? I kind of doubt it, but if I look at the chart, that's what it's telling me. I do think another wave lower is coming. I don't think that 42 was the final bottom. I think we're headed lower than that. How much lower? I'm not exactly sure, but we're going to have some extended coverage of crude oil in our post-game segment after the feature interview with Alex Gurevich. We've got Tracy Sukart, who, of course, a lot of people know as Shy Girl on Twitter, joining us. So be sure to stay tuned for that as well, folks.
All right. Well, Eric, you know, when I was looking at the charts on crude oil, you know, when we were talking with Alistair last week, we were talking about some of these retracement levels. And when I look at things like Fibonacci's and other technical approaches, some of the overhead resistance on crude on my charts anyway, come in the $46, $47 area. I mean, a 48 to 49 kind of retest is like a full 61.8 retracement. It's definitely plausible, but if crude oil here was to fail at this 46, 47 range and roll over, it, like you were just suggesting, heading right right back to the lows and even lower is almost certainly in the cards. And so it'll be very interesting to watch over the next week or two what happens. Now, Eric, moving on to gold here. Gold on Monday had that big event where there was close to $2 billion of gold contracts dumped on the market in 1 minute. And it put gold prices down $20 on the news. And it was really interesting to watch how gold reacted to it. I mean, it worked its way almost back above 12. It did go temporarily above the 1250 area. And now we find ourselves down around this 1244 area as we are doing this recording. What's interesting about gold for me here, though, is that you would, at least from a natural intermarket relationship perspective, I would think that the weakening U.S. dollar would allow gold to actually rally in this environment. And we're really seeing that the weak U.S. dollar is not giving gold any traction whatsoever. What's your feeling on gold here?
Well, I agree with that. You know, the weakening U.S. dollar, you'd think it would be a boost for crude oil and for gold, typically. Well, crude oil is getting the boost, and there's no surprise there. Gold, what we saw, even with a dumping of contracts on Monday, and that kind of thing happens a lot in the gold market, what it did is it pushed it right down to just kiss and touch its 200-day moving average, which it can't seem to get below. But as it bounces off of it, it only has a little ways to go. I'm showing 1237 spot 50 as the 200-day moving average on the nearest futures chart, and only 1256 for the 50-day moving average. So it seems like we're kind of range-bound between the 200-day and the 50-day, and I'm watching for a clean breakout in one direction or the other, either below the 200 or above the 50. And if we go below the 200, a death cross won't be far behind, and I think that could portend lower gold prices. If we see a break decisively first above the 50 and then above the recent high, let's say we get a rally here that takes us above 1300, then I'd really have to say something's up with gold to the bullish side. But until that happens, I'm waiting to see whether or not the 200-day is going to hold, and I'm kind of thinking it probably won't here.
Well, you know, moving on now to treasury bonds, there's clearly no shortage of price action in almost all the major intermarkets. Treasury bonds didn't waste any time selling off as the yield spiked when we were trading around that 215 level earlier late last week. We now suddenly find ourselves jumped. We almost hit 230 on the upside, trading around 227 right now. What's your thinking here on interest rates?
Well, a lot of people are saying, oh, it's all about Mario Draghi and his hawkish comments. And I certainly think that's what started it. But, you know, Draghi's comments got us from 215 or something to 218, 220. We're all the way back almost to 230 now. So I don't know how far this is going to go. I also noticed that the 2s-10s spread, that's the difference between the yield on the 2-year and the 10-year treasury, has finally started to bounce back a little bit this week after just looking like it was in a death spiral for the last several weeks. So will that hold? Are we seeing a reversal in direction here that's meaningful? And is it just the ECB's turning hawkish in Draghi's speech? Or is there more to it? I really don't have a firm opinion yet, but this has gotten my attention, and I'm watching it very closely. I want to ask definitely Alex Gurevich, because he's a big bond guy, for his perspective on what's going on here.
Well, thanks for that market wrap, Eric. Back to join us as this week's featured interview guest is Alex Gurevich, the CIO of Honte Investments in San Francisco. Eric's interview with Alex is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Alex Gurevich, the CIO at Honte Investments. Alex, it's great to have you back on the program. I want to start with the news that seems to be on everybody's mind this week, which is poor Mario Draghi has apparently been misjudged by the market, according to the ECB. And of course, the Bank of England is in the news this week. Give us an update on what's happening with central bankers in Europe and the UK, and what do you think it means in the big picture of how it's going to impact global markets as we see maybe a change of direction to more hawkishness from the ECB?
Hello. Okay, so it's good to be back. And the subject du jour is definitely ECB and also Bank of England. Generally, I think that we have developed a pattern over the last few years of ECB throwing curveballs to investors. And the volatility after ECB meetings sometimes is somewhat strange. Some people may remember the December 2015 ECB meeting, which caused a huge move on euro and interest rates, while message was rather mixed. Personally, I think that the ECB message is staying rather mixed and rather consistent. They're kind of switching towards tapering, towards a slightly less dovish stance. It's very hard to call it hawkish if they have negative interest rates and purchasing assets at a little slower pace. And that may or may not happen sometime several months from now. So just think about how many layers we have here. We have still negative interest rates. We have them still aggressively purchasing assets and increasing their balance sheet. And they're talking about possibly setting a time to decrease the pace of purchasing those assets. It's like we're talking like fourth or fifth derivative here. And all of this probably not happening until 2018. So I think just market is just being skittish, and they read Draghi a little too dovish a few months ago, a few weeks ago, and it read him a little too hawkish now. But in reality, where we're going to be 6 months from now really has nothing to do with the current volatility of interpretations. So having said that, we're kind of almost an unprecedented area here. We have a central bank talking about tapering. We have one precedent of QE and tapering, which is the United States. There is no rule that it has to go exactly the same way, but we have one thing to guide by. And what happened after U.S. tapered? We had a kind of knee-jerk sell-off in U.S. bonds, which actually a few months later rectified and ended up in a huge rally. So tapering did not really cause interest rates to go up. However, it did cause dollar to go up, and very dramatically. And this is part of the reason one of my core positions for 3 years has been to be short euro from somewhere early 2014 to early 2017. And I've closed down this position entirely, and I am focusing now on being short Swiss franc in that sector. The reason is that I am worried about euro rally. If you looked at short euro or whatever, long dollar versus short euro, it has very good carry for dollar, and interest rate differentials are still very high and very favorable to dollar. So euro would have to do really well over the next 10 years for you to lose money by being short euro. But the risk reward is just not as good as it used to be, given the risk of ECB following through to this strategy of tapering and maybe gradually beginning to get rates to zero. I don't know how many years it will take them to go to positive rates, if ever. The reason why I wouldn't be long euro is because I'm just not sure that it's all going to happen, because U.S. may start rolling over very soon, and if Europe sees a contagion of slowdown, they're probably never going to follow through with getting rates even to zero. So they will just forever carry on very severely negative real interest rate, which I think eventually will erode euro. So it's kind of a two-sided game to me. However, to me, why Switzerland is very interesting is because those guys are not tapering squat. They're just going to sit on really negative rates, and they're going to be happy with that because they actually want Swiss franc to be weaker, and it is very strong against euro. It's much stronger than they thought was already very strong, which was 120. And I think if Europe will go the positive way, we think Euro-Swiss will go to like 130, and Swiss National Bank will be very happy with that. On the flip side, Swiss franc is not so cheap against dollar either. And if euro is going to be weaker, it's going to probably drag Swiss franc with it. And all along, the carry is best, again, for being short Swiss franc. We've seen the decoupling beginning to happen today. Like Swiss franc is beginning to weaken against euro. I think it has much further to go. And the only way Swiss franc can strengthen against euro if there will be some kind of geopolitical or any kind of other meltdown. That's what I would be worried about if I were the other way on Euro-Swiss.
Let's tie the euro conversation back to the U.S. dollar, because we've had quite a few guests on the program articulate very intelligent sounding logical arguments that are bullish the U.S. dollar. But boy, look at the chart, especially in the last couple days. As we're speaking on Wednesday afternoon, the last couple days of action in the dollar index has been just, you know, falling off a cliff. Is that transitory just as a result of the euro rallying, or is there more to this picture as what's going on with the dollar?
Well, I think I would separate it maybe into several different ways to look at it. First of all, I'm not a big chart person. Having said that, each of the last 3 years, including 2015 and 2016, right around this time was the peak of dollar weakness towards the end of June, and then dollar picked up in the second half of the year. So we have a little bit of historical pattern there, and dollar is still still stronger against developed markets than it was a year ago, 2 years ago. So I would not read too much into this. I think broad dollar index is kind of in a corridor for the last couple of years, with, I think, general central tendency still for dollar to go stronger if you look at a long enough chart. And if instead of looking at price charts, which are not fully meaningful, you look at total return charts, which are much more meaningful because they actually reflect making or losing money. And total return divergence, if you look at dollar yen or dollar euro, that's already beginning to significant accumulation of total return over the last 2 or 3 years. That's several extra percent, because a dollar carries a couple of percent against euro and yen, and 2.5% against Swiss a year. Over 2 or 3 years, that accumulates pretty serious difference on how charts look. So that's the same with emerging markets on the other side. All this stuff like Brazil and Mexico and Turkey perform much better than they look on the price charts because they have huge carry. And I think people looking at the price charts just look at wrong charts. That's one of the pet peeves I have. Secondly, I am not necessarily a very strong proponent of this very broad, unconditional dollar bullish story. First of all, to me, dollar bull story is contingent on interest rates proceeding as they're priced, which I think is very unlikely, but it is important to accept the reality of the current markets. If you look at the U.S. yield curve, it currently prices rates, albeit very slowly, but keeping to go up. I think it is somewhat preposterous to think that 2 years from now, Fed would be tightening. The curve should be inverted from 1 year out, all the way out. That's my economic view. But as it is not, and as we price what we currently see, I think a dollar would have to continue strengthening, because otherwise, in order to catch up to that type of interest rate differential, dollar would have to be weakening really, really considerably over the next 10 years, because interest rate differential is so high versus yen, Swiss franc, and euro that the only way you can lose money by dollar weakening another 25%. And I don't think it's possible, but I don't think it's just the most likely scenario. So when I look at total returns, I think dollar is favored by the current level of interest rate, and therefore it is a superior trade to be long dollar, yet you can combine it really well with being long bonds, because if you're wrong on the interest rates, you're going to make much more on the bond side than you will lose on the dollar. That's my view. But having said all this, I think it is important to understand that for 2 years, like 2000, we started dollar bull market with the idiosyncratic weak yen market in 2012. It was not a broad dollar bull in 2012. It was just yen bear, 2012 and 2014. In 2014 and 2015, and in the end it ended up 2016 as well, it ended up to be broad dollar bull market, where dollar was going up against everything. And one by one, various emerging market currencies were collapsing, all like the Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan's and Tanzania's and Nigeria's of the world were all like one by one falling like dominoes. I think that process may be at least partially arrested, and now we have to look at currencies individually. It is very possible that we may enter idiosyncratic euro bull market, but it does not mean euro bull does not mean dollar bear against all other currencies. It just means that euro might be performing as well as dollar or better than dollar, but I think there is a lot of other currencies which have way to go down. For example, to me, that Mexican peso is an uptrend. Ruble has been doing well, even though it's beginning to show some signs of weakness now. Yet, I think in currencies like Swiss franc and Canadian dollar, possibly New Zealand dollar, there is a lot of downside.
You've mentioned the Swiss franc being overvalued, that it being a lot of downside. What would be your favorite pair to trade that against? You'd go short Swiss against long what if you wanted to make that trade? Okay.
Dollar.
So long
because
dollar, short Swiss.
Yeah, fits the portfolio best because it's a very good risk on trade, which I think will do well if the world does well, and it pairs really well with being long U.S. Treasury bonds.
Now, a lot of people have written about the so-called Trump reflation trade rolling over, and I think you've written quite a bit about this in some of your letters to your subscribers. If I look at the commodity charts, boy, CRB, you know, the commodities definitely are echoing that story, but it seems like the S&P 500 didn't get the memo if things are supposed to be rolling over. What's going on with this very strong divergence that we're seeing with so much strength in U.S. equities when we're seeing weakness in so many other sectors?
Well, you know, when people stump me by saying why certain market goes up or certain market goes down, I just end up having to say, well, this market is going up because there's more buyers than sellers. In the end, that's just what comes down to. When you're looking at something going up, well, it means that there are flows coming in and there are buyers. Stock market is difficult to gauge. I mean, I think so many people are trying to see where it should be, what it should be doing, and I think it's a very, very difficult occupation to be gauging what stock market should be doing. I think interest rate market is much easier, and that's why I prefer to trade that market, is because you actually have everything settled eventually. Bonds either default or they don't default. Interest rates have, interest rate swaps are being set to actual LIBOR settings, and if you hold your 10-year notes long enough and fund them at whatever the funding rate is, you either lose money or make money. Stocks, it's very unhinged thing. It's very hard to say what are they going to do and why. Yet, in my opinion, and probably have seen me writing about this, the whole Trump inflation trade was pure and very long shot speculation. So we have a new administration. It says that it wants to do certain things. And market took it to reprice treasury bonds by 100 basis points, reprice stock market, reprice dollar and a whole bunch of other things, but nothing yet happened. None of the stimulus promised by the administration has yet happened. And honestly, right now, we're in no better place than we were 6 months ago. The only thing that did happen is in 2016, dollar strengthened, which led to somewhat incremental tightening of economic conditions. And what else happened is that interest rates went up. And long-term interest rates stabilized, and they're not at the high now, but short-term rates did go up. And that is not huge. It's not like catastrophic. 1.25% short-term interest rates are not a cause to call police, but it is, they are higher. So all we have is a lot of speculation and incrementally tighter economic conditions. Now, I think some of it has been offset by rising asset prices, like in stock market, because rising stock market can kind of create wealth effect and create some artificial easing of monetary conditions. But I think lately, I mean, stock market is still doing well, but it's kind of stabilized. So you don't really have that continuous wealth effect going as a total tidal wealth of wealth coming behind us. And we're seeing somewhat soft economic numbers. And it is really not surprising. I mean, if you asked me 6 months ago or 9 months ago, I wouldn't be surprised to see it, and I think I've been talking about this a lot. Like, well, all this de facto tightening of 2016 would not show in the numbers in winter. It takes at least several months, if not longer, for anything to feed into the economy. So we're beginning to see, in terms of historical pattern, I think we're beginning to see a situation which occurs when a tightening cycle is fairly mature. We can still have, for example, you're asking me why equities are making highs. Well, they made new highs at the end of 2007. And I'm not saying it all of this 2007, but in the end of 2007, from the perspective of general public, things blew up in 08, 09, but really things blew up in 07. Things already blew up in 07. The financial market freeze had happened, right? Fed was already forced to take measures to ease by then, and the credit spreads were blowing out already, and yet stock market was still pushing to the new highs, propelled by, I guess, anticipation of easier Fed for policy or by whatever else. So stock market is not necessarily a very reliable indicator. It is just what it is.
Let's come back to the Treasury market then, because I know you do quite a lot of work there. We had about a year ago Jeff Gundlach calling, putting a nail in a coffin, supposedly, saying, okay, that's it, 1.35, whatever that low yield in the 10-year was. He said, that's it, we'll never see lower, the secular reversal is upon us. Do you agree with that view, or do you think that we may still have lower Treasury yields yet to come in this 35-year bull market in U.S. Treasuries?
First of all, kudos to him. He did have some really good timing calls on Treasury markets. I don't try to time as precisely as he does. What I would say is that I don't think in terms of yields, lows on yields. I think only in terms of total returns once again. What I am thinking of, which is very different, yield charts are kind of meaningless. You have to look at roll-adjusted futures charts or total return charts. Are you making money or losing money by holding and funding your Treasuries as a leverage trader? So if you bought a 10-year note at 1.35, which is whatever was the lowest yield last summer, I actually think you will have made money by the time it expires. Because I think the average rate from there on for the next 10 years is more likely to be below, the average funding rate for 10-year notes is more likely to be below 1.35 than above 1.35. Whether the actual yield can go to all sorts of places, because it's an asset. It goes up, it goes down. Who knows? That would be really contingent to say whether we had the lows of yields in the near future would be the same for me as to try to predict the depth and the scope of nearby recessions, which is very hard. Having said all this, I see absolutely no signs of secular bull market and secular disinflationary trend being intact, like zero, not even like a tiniest blip of a sign of the end of a secular market. All the negative or like inflationary signals that we've seen were purely cyclical. There hasn't been no secular signal at all. Nothing happened over the last year that has not been extremely consistent with the last nine corrections in the bond markets, which were from 94, there was maybe like eight or nine major corrections in U.S. treasuries. And this last correction in the scope, in their velocity, was just extremely similar to the previous ones. And it ended as when I called the end of it, that's when the end happened. And it's been behaving very, very consistently. Like the pattern is so repetitive that I see no reason to think that this cycle is ending.
Now, of course, if you're going to have a view that's bullish treasuries, you've got to think about inflation. Some people have said the major deflationary trend is ending and we're going to shift back to an inflationary secular backdrop. Would you agree with that? Where do you see the inflation trend going?
I see absolutely no reason to think that. I have like zero evidence of that. I see some cyclical inflationary forces. Like, yes, we have cyclically a little tighter labor market. We had a cyclical uptick in wages, which may or may not feed in actual prices. But I don't know where people are taking secular ideas from. I literally cannot understand where they see even the tiniest sign of secular inflation. It may happen. Don't misunderstand me. It may very well be true, but I find that idea that we have a secular shift in inflation completely speculative at this stage. I see the trend, I see the cycles, I see things that have been in place for the last several decades still in place.
We've had several of our guests suggest that the European Union is maybe at the beginning of the end and that the exit contagion is probably higher than some people, especially recently. It seems like everybody's breathing a big sigh of relief that everything is all cured for the European Union. I'm not so sure that it's cured. So how do you see the situation evolving for the European Union? I know you particularly are interested in the Swiss franc as a currency trade. What else do you see in terms of macro opportunities around Europe?
Well, I'll be honest with you. Ever since European Union was formed, I've been a skeptic of it. However, it has consistently surprised me by being more durable than I would have thought possible. Interestingly, I was correct about 10 and 12 years ago. I don't know, it's hard to document, but like in 2000, somewhere around 2004, 2005, I say I would want to be long all Euribor futures, which imply rates above zero in Europe for essentially ever. I think I had this view for wrong reasons, but like weirdly it came to be true. But I was also generally skeptic of Europe. I think over the last few years, I turned around and I actually started to favor European equity markets, and it turned out to be more correct to a certain extent. Europe, it is really somewhat, we're in unprecedented territory. First of all, Europe without wars, we've never seen anything like this before. I don't know if people are in a hurry to give it up in some ways, so there is this very strong, I think, attachment many people have to this idea of European Union. And yet, we are having a very big geopolitical shakeup of the European Union, partially exacerbated by the refugee problem. When Brexit started to happen, one of the things I said is, well, you know, the English and the British in general have a very good track record of basically sailing off when there are troubles on the continent. Just like whenever there are troubles on the continent, they close the channel and manage to sit it out quite well. We have hundreds of years of history of that happening, and maybe they're correct to, so to say, close the channel. I think it's very hard to speculate. I think European Union can surprise people by its resilience, but it also can surprise people by how quickly it could disintegrate from visible complete peace and stability to total chaos.
Let's move around the globe to Asia. Kyle Bass and several other people have had very outspoken views on both Japan and China, saying that JGBs are probably in trouble. And in China's case, there's a view that eventually China will be forced in order to cope with this credit expansion that they've seen. A lot of people think it will collapse, force China to recapitalize its banks and have to markedly devalue the yuan along the way, sending a wave of deflation around the globe. How do you feel about those views, and what do you see in terms of your crystal ball for both Japan and China?
Well, my views on China and Japan are very divergent, first of all. So on China, I tend to agree with China skeptics who think that China is building a huge problem of enormous buildup of private debt, which is unprecedented both in absolute and in relative terms, both in terms of current condition and the rate of growth. And the China, the kind of the concept of China being a whole economy of China being a giant Ponzi scheme is very close to my heart. I think what is people might be misguided is the fact that Chinese economic cycles are very slow. China is like on an 80-year, not like on a 7-year cycle like U.S., but like an 80-year cycle. So it's very hard to time. I think the probability of China blowing up one way or another is extremely high. Yet the timing of it is really like when people were calling for it to blow up 2 years ago and it didn't happen. That's like a microscopic time frame for China. We could have 10 more years of what we see, or it could have a Minsky moment and collapse tomorrow. I think it is less likely that it will forever do like that kind of gradual slide and adjustment of how people think that it's just going to reform into Western-like superpower. I give it this extremely low probability to this event, because there is no precedent of something like this result being resolved in that way. No communist country ever became a Western-style superpower. It would be all of those things. If China somehow managed to get out of the situation that they're in, it would be the first in history of civilization on probably like 100 different items. And it could be first because China is very unique in so many ways. But if you look at 5,000 years of Chinese history, they actually have been in this position before, in position of being emergent global power. And every time they manage to disintegrate themselves one way or another, and I think odds are still that they will do it again. So that's my view on China. And when it comes to Japan, I'm actually very constructive on Japan. I do not think JGBs are going to blow up. I do think yen will get weaker. Kai is my favorite stock market. That's the only market I'm actually long, has been long over the last year, slightly over a year, and it's Nikkei. I think that paradoxically, Japan is in a much better position right now than Europe or U.S. to take advantage of automatization and of their inverse demographic trend that was considered to be a problem might actually become their strength.
I know you've done some work on Canada as well. Obviously, a lot of people are concerned about a real estate bubble in Canada, and the currency is not looking exceptionally strong with the weakness that we've seen in crude oil. What do you see on Canada's horizon?
Well, I think I see the risks high in Canada. I see Canada as a high-risk country right now because, as you mentioned, I think there are signs of rolling estate bubble beginning to roll over, and that could hurt them a lot. I think we're really going to have to watch oil prices fairly closely to see which way Canada is more likely to lean. Canada is not like a one-trick pony like some of, it's not like a Mid-Eastern country which has nothing but oil. It's a pretty developed and diversified economy. I think the two things to watch out is you don't have to watch China, because influx of money from China was a big thing that used to support Canada. That will slow down at any point, or even like if for some regulatory reasons, real estate flows will slow down. That will cause actually a serious slowdown in Canada. If U.S. slows down, Canada could come under a lot of pressure. If somehow U.S. demand goes down, and U.S. is just an overwhelmingly largest Canadian trading partner. And Canada, I think, just got surpassed by China as being the biggest trading partner of the United States. But on the flip side, I think it's probably like off the charts U.S. for Canada, right? So we have to watch oil, we have to watch real estate, we have to watch slows down in U.S. and China. And I think it's hard to substantiate this, but I think to be very precise about this, but I think on some kind of qualitative level, if Canada gets seriously hit from one of those directions, they could be in a uniquely vulnerable position. I think Canadian economy, Canadian banks could be prove to be very vulnerable. You could have serious equity corrections. They might end up weakening their currency very considerably. I think we could see Canadian dollar going to where we saw it at the beginning of the century, and there is a big downside. So there is a big downside. I think Canadian dollar could get some tailwind from if the dollar is just broadly weakened. So, for example, like last couple of days, okay, so euro got stronger, and in sympathy, Canadian dollar got stronger, but I don't necessarily think it's a long-term effect. I think we may anticipate the test of 160 sooner rather than later on Canadian dollar.
You mentioned oil a few times in talking about Canada. Do you have a view on what's driving this sell-off in oil and whether it's set to continue or reverse?
I'm not an oil analyst, but I've heard a lot of smart people talk about oil, and there does appear to be an oil glut. appears to be huge oversupply and a lot of inventories of oil. Oil producing countries under budgetary pressures, and the combination of all of those things really creates a dynamic for oil, which is not so great. Interestingly, also, developed world is really not growing its demand that much anymore. I think we're really crossing over to the place where electric cars and wind power and solar power and whatnot is really putting pressure on fossil fuels without even any kind of specific environmental regulations. And we may get to the point where oil demand will start falling. People might argue, well, oil is still, there's still a finite amount of oil around there. So proponents of peak oil theory think that even if demand doesn't grow that much, at some point we're going to still run out of oil. I personally don't believe in it. I think civilization is developing and shifting much faster than we're going to run out of oil. I think 20 years from now, if you ask me as a futurist, I think oil will be irrelevant as an energy source. Not just, it might be relevant as a source of bioorganic materials, but I think it'll become irrelevant as an energy source. So it really has a fairly short half-life to me right now.
And would you see something else? I mean, obviously, oil has been what has provided the solution to the need for liquid fuels for many, many decades. Would you see some other source of liquid fuels, or do you think vehicles can be powered by some other way, electric vehicles, or what?
I think the development in batteries is sufficiently robust to get rid of liquid fuels entirely, without even any major technological breakthroughs. But there is two sides of the story. So oil is, we can look at fossil fuels as a source of original source of energy and also as a source of compact energy storage. Compact energy storage is the biggest civilizational problem. Like it has been very hard to have anything better than a tank of gasoline to store energy. A lot of other sources of energy are explosive or toxic or dangerous. But I think the progress in batteries seems to be already clearly robust enough without any major breakthroughs to really shift away from that. And now when we talk about the original source of energy, my personal opinion that we're going to have to go to thermonuclear energy. I think the energy needs will never be met by any other source. I think the biggest best bet would be cold fusion.
Let's move on to precious metals, a topic that is near and dear to many of our listeners' hearts. I've actually been kind of surprised by how strong gold has been, considering the very marked sell-off in other commodities. What do you think is going on there? Why is gold catching such a bid when other commodities aren't?
Well, gold is a very different from industrial commodities, right? Industrial commodities, to some extent, reflect industrial activity, which has been possibly softening and thus weakening industrial commodities. Gold is more like one of the currencies, so there is a tautological correlation. When dollar is slightly weaker, gold in dollar terms tend to be slightly stronger. If we don't know anything else about anything, right, all we know, dollar is weakening. Since we express gold in dollar terms, it looks a little stronger. If you express gold, for example, in euro terms over the last few weeks, it would probably look not so great. So that's first remark I would make. I think there is a lot of antsiness in the global community, and people like to buy gold when they're antsy and just a little worried about things. I think gold in general, if you really think about, like, where do you go with your safe assets? If you look at something like Switzerland or Japan or Europe or Sweden, where we have negative interest rates, it's almost like gold is almost like cheaper to hold than cash. Because you have to pay interest on your cash, or you have to pay storage on gold. Typically, the one thing that worked against gold is it was costly to hold. Like if your gold, even if the gold is generally tends to be in an uptrend over the years with inflation, but it used to cost money to hold it. But now in terms of all currencies except dollar, in terms of developed markets, gold is not so expensive to hold anymore. So it only costs in dollar terms to hold, but when dollar comes under pressure and people don't want to be in dollar, I think people are just getting squeezed into gold. And that's it's kind of a two-way process. I mean, I think you could ask a question why gold is not weaker, but I could also ask a question why gold is not much stronger, because there are many reasons for gold to go up.
Let's move on to a subject that has me very curious, which is we have seen in the United States a big political divide where the political left seems to be absolutely convinced that Russia has hacked the U.S. elections, attempted to influence the outcome of the U.S. presidential election. President Trump is actually a KGB agent, I think, according to some of these folks, although I think the KGB was eliminated about 20 years ago in favor of the FSB. On the other hand, the political right in the U.S. says this is a witch hunt. It's absolute nonsense, and there's no basis in reality for any of it. Without taking sides on who's right on that, I can't help but observe the United States is really saying a lot of things and taking sanctions against Russia in some cases. What would be the economic implications? How is this going to affect markets if the political left in the United States continues to punish Russia for things that Russia may or may not have actually done wrong?
Politics aside, Russia is in somewhat precarious economic condition. Now, I traveled to Russia last year, and the previous time I went to Russia was in 2009. And there was a very stark contrast. In 2009, the feeling was all our Western world was in turmoil economically. But in Russia, everything was actually going pretty well. You could see things being built and everything, developments, new highways, new bridges, new tunnels. Just stuff looked like positive and upbeat, especially coming from U.S. in 2009. And in 2016, I felt the reverse of it. I felt our world, Western world, is relatively upbeat. But in Russia, internally, there was a lot of economic unrest, a lot of economic unhappiness. A lot of small businesses were under pressure, going out of business. A lot of people who depended on discretionary spending, who were doing well, like the type of businesses which were dependent on discretionary spending, which tend to do well, were getting really seriously worried. And small sample of people I spoke to, the mood was worse. Since then, Russian currency has stabilized, and that possibly helped. Currency, in fact, has rallied a bit since that trip, and maybe there is a sense of higher stability there, but the position is precarious because they're going to need this oil to stay at certain level to keep going. And I'm not even sure. Russian oil is not super cheap. I'm not sure how well they're doing even with oil like close to $40. There is a lot of stuff there that is a lot of growth that is being subsidized by energy revenue. And Russia is a country with a lot of geopolitically tense borders, some internal tensions. I would refer people to Stratford Economic Theory and, I guess, George Friedman's book, The Next 100 Years. I don't know if you read this book. It creates a very interesting like forecast landscape for 21st century, and so far it's been really, really followed through well. And one of the things that it forecasts is basically Russia getting really aggressive in this decade, and which leads to its eventual, it may or may not happen. But I think there are definitely some risks there.
Finally, before we close, I'd like to move on. Please give our listeners who may not be familiar with what you do at Hante Investments a sense of what you do there, and also your book, The Next Perfect Trade. Tell us what people can expect to find there.
My book, The Next Perfect Trade, I wrote it in 2014-2015, and that's basically the summary of my strategic system, which is a system of selecting what I call superior trades. The idea behind this book is instead of trying to forecast economic outcomes, to find trades that just ex ante are good trades, types of trades that tend to make money regardless of economic outcome. And it goes from fairly basic principles to more complex principles involving interactions between asset classes. So this is how I trade for myself, and this is the way I built my business, Hante Investments. It's basically an outgrowth of my family office, which now takes outside capital. It's only available to accredited investors. But basically what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to run money long-term based on selecting superior trades, which is not really worried about daily or even monthly P&L volatility, do what I'm doing with my own money, you know, not competing with any benchmarks or any other outside parameters, just trying to make money over the long term. And those investors who want to have the same financial experience as my own money tend to come along.
Okay, well, I cannot thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Now, Eric, we got a lot of positive feedback for bringing a second guest onto the show for an extended crude oil coverage in our post-game segment last week. So this week, Tracy Shuchart, perhaps better known as @ShyGirl on Twitter, joins us for our discussion on the crude oil markets. Tracy, welcome aboard.
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me on.
Well, Eric, you know, I just wanted to quickly comment on Alex's interview. There were so many amazing sound bites in that interview, but I think the one thing that resonated with me was the fact that he was very clear on saying that the secular bond bull market is not over, and almost everything that he sees is a cyclical trend. What did you take away from that interview?
Well, I agree with that. I think he makes an excellent point. I'm really, really hoping we can get Jeff Gundlach on the program, because he was so bold in saying last year, okay, that's it. Today is the day that the 35-year bond bull market ended, and it's all uphill from here in yields. And I would love to hear his rationale for how he can be so confident of that. And the thing is, I mean, he nailed it to the day in terms of he's been right so far. So the guy definitely knows something. How he can be so sure that we're not going to see another lower yield, I don't know. I still am in, I think, the camp that says we are way long in the tooth in this business cycle. Eventually, there's going to be a recession, and I won't be surprised if we see a new secular low in bond yields. So I want to get back to our second feature guest, Tracy Shuchart. That name is so hard for me because you see it written and it looks like Shuchart, like she was born to be a technical analyst. So I'm so glad that to have you on the program finally, Tracy. You know, as bearish as I've been about crude oil, even I said last week, okay, $42, we're way overdue for a bounce. We're getting that bounce, but I don't want to assume it's a bounce. So what's your take? Was $42.05 the final low and it's never going to go below that? Or is this just a bounce, which is my take? And if it is a bounce, how far do you think we bounce before the trend reverses back to the downside?
Well, definitely, I don't think that the lows are in for the year whatsoever. I do think 42 is a big level. We were due for a bounce. You know, you're going to have people start short covering at those lower levels, so it doesn't really surprise me. You know, I'm looking in the 47, 48 range. I think around there, we would be at the top of that trend line and we'll come down into some new lows into the 30s. It's also a seasonal downtrend for the rest of the year. So to see 30s, upper 30s, middle 30s, even lower 30s, nothing changes by the end of the year.
Well, I very much agree with that outlook. It's very consistent with mine, but I'm having a hard time really getting my head around what is going on with Saudi Arabia and OPEC. And the way I've looked at this situation for the last several months, it seemed to me that Saudi Arabia and OPEC have had two principal goals. Number one, keep the front month price above $50 until they get Saudi Aramco IPO'd, which is supposedly going to happen in 2018. Second, they appear to be trying to engineer backwardation into the WTI term structure so that the late 2017 contracts are high priced. That's more money for OPEC, but the 18 and 19 contracts are lower priced. That's making it harder for U.S. shale to secure the financing they need. And they seem to be having some success with that. But for the last couple of weeks, OPEC's messaging has just gone dead, gone silent. And the fact that they've become silent at a time when the market was selling off so aggressively, it just blows my mind, Tracy. So what do you think is going on here? Have they decided to give up on this strategy and go back to competing for market share? Or do you think that this change in the royal family, where Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, is maybe going to come into power over the other guy that was supposed to succeed the king, has changed the strategy? What's up? And why have OPEC and Saudi Arabia been silent during such a big sell-off in crude oil prices?
It's kind of a multi-part question, but let's start with the fact that I think initially what OPEC didn't realize when they went initially forward with these cuts is that they didn't expect shale resiliency. They didn't expect production to rebound so quickly. So when that happened and their policy sort of backfired on them, now you kind of see a switch and change of policy to they started talking about exports, right? So what they're going to do is they're going to basically lower exports to the United States, and hopefully that'll bring supplies down in the West. However, what they're really doing is they're diverting those same exports to Japan and China. So the glut is still there. So this isn't actually working if you look at the overall global supply of crude oil. So I think what their next best option is to do is basically let oil prices drop. Suddenly you're starting to hear all of the OPEC nations say, we're not, no more deeper cuts. We're not even considering it anymore. They're very silent. They're watching it drop. And the thing is that what you don't realize is that, you know, OPEC nations are able to sustain much lower oil prices than shale producers are. So oil for them is okay at 45, at 40, at 35. It's even survivable at 30. Whereas for U.S. shale, that's impossible except for maybe tier one producers in the Permian Basin. So best bet, in my opinion, really is to go silent, let the prices drop, and let natural selection take its course. And suddenly you have market balance because these shale producers are going to fall off more aggressively as if lower oil prices are sustained for longer. Meaning, you know, if we start getting, you know, into the 30s and that sustained for a few months, then shale's going to have a lot of problems and a lot of problems getting, you know, new loans in the fall and again in April, given, you know, they're not going to be able to pay their debts and they're not going to be able to produce. So in my opinion, I think that's kind of what they're really letting happen right now. And also the fact that this IPO now has, you know, it was supposed to be 2017, so they needed to get oil prices up right away. Now it's 2018. I doubt it's even going to happen in 2018, to be honest. I think this is going to drag on for a lot longer. You know, I think if it even happens, which I have my doubts about, I think they're looking at least 2019, 2020 before they can get this all together on the back end even. So, you know, given that they have a little bit of time now, they can kind of alter their policy and let oil prices drop.
Well, that's fascinating because I agree with everything you're saying. It makes logical sense. But if Saudi Arabia is counting on lower oil prices to shake out shale, I think they've got something else coming to them because the shale guys learned their lesson the last time through this, and they've been hedging aggressively. It used to be shale operators only hedged just to the minimum amount that they could get away with in order to satisfy their banks. Everything I've been reading has been saying that the shale guys are hedging a lot more of their forward production. So although you're right that sustained prices in the 30s for like more than a year or something, that would certainly make it difficult to finance new shale wells. But they can continue to do what they're doing for quite a while with the hedges they already have in place. Am I right about that? And I guess what I have to hear myself talking, I think, wait a minute, what data do I have to really base that on? Where can I find out how much forward production the shale guys have set aside and how many more wells can they drill based on the inventory of hedges that are already in place? But if you look at how we've returned to a straight contango in the market, you can still hedge if you're a shale operator. If you think this is going on, this bounce that we're seeing right now might be a fantastic opportunity for the shale drillers to dramatically increase their hedges and basically buy some budget to drill a whole bunch of more oil wells to ride this out for the next year or two.
Absolutely. They're going to need to do that. I mean, what was happening when we had higher oil prices after this cut initially at the beginning of the year? You know, they were starting to let all their hedges fall off, right? So they do need to go in and hedge. And if you look at the COT data, you can see on this that the short open interest for commercial hedgers has gone way down compared to what it was last year, because a lot of them just assumed that we were going to have higher oil prices. This OPEC cut was going to work, and a lot of them just let their hedges roll off. So if they were smart, which they are, I'm sure, they're going to take this opportunity on a bounce to start hedging into the back end of the curve. We already know Mexico, you know, does that every year. They're about to start their next round for 2018 in August. So, you know, you've got Mexico doing it, Pemex doing it, but so far, the U.S. shale producers haven't been aggressively hedging as they once were. So they should take this opportunity to start hedging again. I agree with that.
Well, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens here. But ultimately, I'm sure we can all agree that someday we're going to get through this massive glut, this rebalancing that you and I both agree is not really going to happen in 2017 the way OPEC might have liked us to believe. It has to happen someday. So when do you think that is? How long? Is it a matter of years before we get back to rebalance and inventories are drawn down to historically normal levels? Or what do you see in the longer term for oil prices and the oil market from here?
I think it's going to take a lot to really get back to market rebalance. I mean, if you notice that everybody keeps pushing it back and pushing it back. And the problem is that first, we're not really seeing the demand. Second of all, we also have most of the demand that everybody's counting on is from China. What happens if they stop buying 10% of what they're buying? 10%, that floods the market even more. We also have aggressive policies in these big demand nations, India and China, that are going forward with electric vehicles and things like that. So I'm not sure that we're going to see any kind of market balance unless short of everybody stops producing in the near future. I just don't see it.
Tracy, one last question. You know, I'm mostly a fundamentals-driven guy. I use a little bit of technical analysis, but I'll call it old-school technical analysis. I read Murphy 15 years ago and know about trend lines and moving averages. Something I know that you are a big proponent of is market volume profile. And frankly, I think that I misunderstood this because I know that all of the day traders swear by it. I kind of thought it was a short time horizon tool that didn't really apply to someone like myself who makes trades that last for weeks or months, not for hours. You told me off the air that I've basically got it all wrong, that market volume profile is something that really could apply to any time horizon. So for people like myself who don't know too much about it, can you tell us what it is, why you like it so much, what it's good for, and where people can learn more about it?
Sure. Well, first, many people can confuse it with a volume profile, which is completely different. What TPO is pretty much it's a market structure as opposed to, you know, just volume in the market. So what you're actually looking at a footprint of the actual auction in blocks. So if you're, say, a day trader, you can use it daily, right? If you're sort of a swing trader, you can use the weekly. If you're a bigger swing trader, you start using the yearly on it or the monthly on it. But any time horizon, really, you can use it because you can still see what the structure of the market looks like either on a daily basis, a weekly basis, or a monthly basis. If you're interested, Jay Dalton has excellent books on it. I would start with Mind Over Markets. That's an excellent resource. CME Group also puts out their own PDF on it that's available on their website. That's it.
All right, Tracy, you know, I wanted to just touch on, I was looking at some of your tweets and you were talking about the ES, the S&P 500 futures markets there. And obviously today was just a huge, huge day. I mean, we had almost a 40-point plunge and then a bounce. What's your feeling? Does this change the direction of the uptrend of the markets? Are we now going to go in through some sort of a bigger correction? Like, what are the levels you're looking at here on the S&P?
Well, I mean, we're sideways lower for right now. So, you know, I don't know how big of a correction we're actually going to get as long as central banks keep buying. You know, the market is sideways down right now. So I do expect every dip sort of to get bought like it is now, with every retrace kind of being lower, at least for the next little while. But I don't think that we're going to have a 50% correction, or, you know, I'm actually looking at higher levels to short. I'm looking at 2460 and 2480 for an actual larger correction. I think this is kind of like in a middle correction.
Now, when you're looking for those upper levels, is that a Fib measurement that you're measuring out there?
Yeah, it's GAN and Elliott, which I'm not a huge proponent of Elliott, but the math kind of all works together, kind of how it's, you know, Fibonacci, GAN, Elliott kind of math that puts us up there.
Oh, that's great. You know, it's really interesting. Just very, when we've seen this big sideways volatile chop just going back and forth, it's really interesting to see whether this selling pressure really just starts to gain momentum, especially with these big spikes in the volatility index. Nonetheless, Eric, is there anything else that you wanted to add to close things up?
Unfortunately, we are going to have to leave it there in terms of time. So I really want to thank Tracy and Alex both for joining us on this program. Please continue, folks, to let us know how you like this format change of bringing a second guest in to our post-game segment, and we sure do need your help promoting the program. So please retweet us, tell your friends, forward your research roundup emails to your friends and colleagues, use our new donate button on the website if you'd like to make a donation to defray our production costs, use our player embed in order to get Macro Voices on your favorite website, but most importantly, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. The more user accounts that we have registered, that's the statistic that Patrick used to recruit the very best feature interview guests. More registered users equals better guests in future months and weeks. So please help us out. Register your account. It won't cost you anything. The benefit to you is that you'll get our free research roundup email, which never contains any kind of advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the coolest free stuff that we could find on the internet, whether that be presentations that go along with our guest interviews or just interesting articles. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
Well, in this week's research roundup, you're going to find obviously the transcript for today's interview. There's also a link to the Macro Tourist article, Too Busy Patting Myself on the Back. Kevin puts into perspective the now growing crowded buy Europe trade. I really enjoyed reading it. There's also a link to a great article discussing Deutsche Bank's ideas on three important regime shifts in the markets. There's also a link to an article written by Steve Keen for Forbes titled There is No Excuse for Janet Yellen's Complacency. There's also a link to an article discussing Lacey Hunt's perspectives titled The Fed Has Undermined the Economy's Ability to Grow. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share the content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for the most recent updates and releases. Also, you can follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.